KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The Trump administration says questions about its deportation flights are too sensitive to share. What role do courts have in checking the president's powers under the Alien Enemies Act? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Federal agencies are scrubbing websites, removing mentions of people of color, women, and transgender folks. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Some of them have been restored, but what is the point of the purge to begin with? Also, with 23andMe in bankruptcy, what happens to all that sensitive data? And how a backup singer for Ray Charles and Gladys Knight is helping lead the fight for caregivers to get more pay. It is Tuesday, March 25th. Happy birthday to Honora. Oscar winner Mikey Madison is 26 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The White House says President Trump retains confidence in his national security advisor, Mike Waltz. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports the White House is downplaying a stunning revelation that a journalist was included in a group chat discussing U.S. military strike plans.
The national security advisor has been under increasing pressure since raising national security concerns over the incident. According to a report in The Atlantic, Waltz accidentally invited the media outlet's editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Goldberg, into a private group chat of top officials discussing U.S. strikes on the Houthis in Yemen. In a phone interview Tuesday with NBC News, President Trump described the situation as, quote, the only glitch in 2 months, and it turned out not to be a serious one. He added, Michael Waltz has learned a lesson, and he's a good man. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Meanwhile, NPR has learned staffers at the Pentagon received an email about a week ago. The email warned Pentagon staffers about a vulnerability in the messaging app Signal. This was the one used by the Trump officials to discuss the military information. A note, NPR CEO Catherine Mayer is on the board of the Signal Foundation. The wife of Vice President Vance is to visit Greenland this week. Mrs. Vance will be joined by Trump administration officials on a trip that is seen as fraught. President Trump has repeatedly said the U.S. will take over Greenland, but NPR's Deepa Shivaram says Greenland is a territory of Denmark.
In an interview with a Greenlandic newspaper over the weekend, the prime minister of Greenland said that the visit from members of the Trump administration was very aggressive. He said that Greenland has to face the seriousness of the situation of the U.S. wanting to annex them. Now, Trump, for his part, says this isn't a provocation. He says it's a purely friendly visit and claimed that the U.S. was invited to visit Greenland, though NPR is not able to confirm if there was an invite.
NPR's Deepa Shivaram reporting. The Kremlin says both the U.S. and Russia are analyzing the outcome of yesterday's talks between their delegations in Saudi Arabia. These stretched for 12 hours. They were focused on expanding U.S. ceasefire efforts in Ukraine. NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the two sides held detailed negotiations, the contents of which would not be revealed to the public. Yet both Washington and Moscow acknowledged the talks focused on expanding a partial ceasefire on attacks on energy infrastructure to now include shipping in the Black Sea. In effect, it's an attempt to resuscitate a 2022 United Nations brokered agreement that tried to guarantee safe passage of Russian and Ukrainian grain and fertilizer shipments out to world markets. The deal later collapsed amid Kremlin complaints that sanctions restrictions prevented exports of Russian fertilizer, prompting speculation the White House is offering some form of sanctions relief this time around. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
This is NPR. Maine's Democratic governor is refusing President Trump's recent demand that she apologize for their clash over transgender athletes. Maine Governor Janet Mills criticized the president's policies instead. Maine Public Radio's Kevin Miller has more.
Last month, Mills told Trump, "See you in court," after he threatened to withhold federal funds unless Maine stops allowing transgender athletes in women's and girls' sports. Trump demanded a full-throated apology from Mills over the weekend. She responded with a stinging critique, speaking to reporters at an event in Bangor.
If the current occupant of the White House wants to protect women and girls, he should start by protecting the women and teenage girls who are suffering miscarriages and dying because they can't get basic life-saving health care in states across this country.
The Trump administration has given Maine until later this week to agree to change its policy. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Miller in Augusta.
Anti-government protests continue to widen in Turkey. This comes after the ruling Turkish government imprisoned the mayor of Istanbul. The mayor is considered the strongest rival to Turkey's longtime president. Protesters are furious. They're filling streets, conducting walkouts, and staging boycotts. A court in Japan has ordered the Unification Church to be dissolved in that country. This is part of an investigation that began with the 2022 assassination of former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. An investigation into his slaying revealed close relationships between the church and some Japanese lawmakers. The Unification Church says it will appeal immediately. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, Layla will speak with a former CIA analyst about the implications of Trump officials using a commercial messaging app to discuss details of an airstrike in Yemen. But first, the Trump administration is refusing to give a federal judge more information about the way it went about deporting hundreds of Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador. Last night, government lawyers invoked the state secrets privilege to keep Judge James Boasberg from gathering more details about the flights. The judge wanted those details to determine whether officials violated his order to pause the deportations because of a lack of due process. The Justice Department says that that information would, quote, undermine or impede future counterterrorism operations, unquote. To get a better understanding of what's going on here, we called someone who has had key positions at the Justice Department and Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the Obama administration. That is Elliot Williams. He was an assistant director at ICE and a deputy assistant attorney general at DOJ, and he's with us now. Good morning.
Hi, Michelle.
So what is state secrets privilege, and when is it typically invoked?
When we think about privileges, they're rules that allow material to be kept out of court. Everyone's heard about attorney-client privilege, where the things you say to your lawyer can't be brought into court, or spousal privilege, conversations you have with your husband or wife or whomever else cannot be brought into court. And state secrets privilege allows the government, when the government is a litigant, to withhold some information from release in court that it has determined relates to national security. Now, to be clear, Michelle, criticism of the use of the state secret privilege has been mounting for decades now. This idea that presidents or presidential administrations are getting quite aggressive and forward-leaning with how much they are asserting the state secret privilege. And to some extent, we're seeing that here.
So did the Obama administration use it? And if so, in what type of cases?
Oh, goodness. I think every administration has at some point. Now, the war on terror which was prosecuted by both the Obama administration and the Bush administration. They would often invoke such a privilege, and sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. But the fact is, and related to this case here, a presidential administration can't simply wave a wand and say that every word they utter related to national security ought be held out of court. And really, it is up to a judge.
Do they have to give the judge a reason why the specific information is covered by that privilege?
Absolutely. And they'll do it outside of public view. They will file sealed affidavits that you and I won't see, but the judge can make the determination as to whether, no, this question could jeopardize U.S. national security, therefore ought not be released in public in court.
So the DOJ lawyers argue that the order, the Trump's in this administration, obviously, argue that mm-hmm. the order to pause these deportations is a, quote, unprecedented and enormous intrusion on the powers of the executive branch. And they're saying that the judge doesn't have jurisdiction there. What do you make of that argument?
I don't think it's a particularly great argument for a host of reasons. I think they are basing their decision for removing these individuals on the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, which has really only ever been invoked in wartime, and attempting to make an argument that Venezuelan gang members or alleged Venezuelan gang members in the United States are themselves engaging in an incursion that is tantamount to an act of war. That is a very broad reading of that statute. In so doing, what the administration has done is then been able to hide behind the state secrets privilege and say that, well, we can't talk about why these gang members or alleged gang members are here and what they've done. And so the judge in this matter is merely attempting to get to the bottom of who are these people? You know, what's your basis for removing them? And what is the evidence you have linking them to acts of the Venezuelan government or acts of international security?
What I think I hear you saying is that this administration is not even willing to make the argument to the judge, even privately. Yeah. Is that accurate? And so what I heard you say earlier is that there are typical disagreements between an administration's efforts to use its authorities as it sees fit and the check provided by the courts. And what I think I hear you saying is that this is out of the bounds of those types of disagreements. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think that's absolutely accurate. And I think it's perfectly it's healthy for our government, for the executive branch to be able to assert its authorities in front of a court. But the notion that the court simply has no jurisdiction over them or ought not be able to even review the question is silly. And moreover, the administration's not doing itself any favors by personally attacking the judge repeatedly and the integrity of the court. So there's a bigger, broader question of public faith in institutions here that the administration's at the heart of. But the core question of does a judge even have the authority to weigh the question is an important one.
Before we let you go, is this case likely headed to the Supreme Court?
I think it is. Whoever loses this appeal, there was an appeal that went to the appeals court here in Washington, D.C. just yesterday. Whoever loses that on a very technical question that came up yesterday is going to appeal this to the Supreme Court. And they have an interest in taking it simply because of the importance of these national security and constitutional questions.
That's Elliot Williams. He is a CNN legal analyst and former assistant director for legislative affairs at U.S. Immigration Customs Enforcement, or ICE, under the Obama administration. Thanks so much for joining us.
Always great to talk to you, Michelle. Take care.
President Trump is blaming an aide to his national security advisor for a stunning intelligence breach. He says one of Michael Waltz's staff added a journalist to a group text where top U.S. officials were making war plans on a private messaging app, Signal. Here's how The Atlantic's editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg explained it on All Things Considered yesterday.
I'm included in a group chat called Houthi PC Small Group. PC in White House parlance stands for Principals Committee. And I look at the group, it's 18 people or so, and it includes what I take to be the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, the Vice President, CIA Director, and so on.
Goldberg says he was skeptical at first, but quickly learned it was, in fact, a space where administration officials were trading detailed texts about weapons and tactics for strikes on Houthi rebels in Yemen. To discuss how extraordinary a breach like this is, we're joined by Ned Price. He was a State Department spokesperson under President Joe Biden and spent more than a decade at the CIA before that. Good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Lila.
So, Ned, you spent more than a decade at the CIA, then time at the State Department, where most recently you were deputy UN ambassador and sat on the Principles Committee, which makes policy decisions on U.S. national security matters. So with that hat on, what was your reaction to hearing top cabinet officials, including the vice president, the secretary of state, the secretary of defense, were discussing war plans on a private messaging app?
You know, Leila, look, I've been dismayed on a number of policy fronts by this administration. That is to say, what I think are the dangerous, reckless decisions that they're making, again, on a policy basis. But it's fair to say that never in my wildest dreams could I have imagined that they'd be this reckless and careless with our national security in terms of how they were going about doing that. In other words, the technical aspect of how they get to these decisions. Over the course of the past 24 hours or so, I've been talking to former colleagues who also sat in on these principal committee meetings. And it's fair to say, Leila, that heads are exploding because, as Jeffrey Goldberg just alluded to, the Principles Committee, it's really the apex of the national security decision-making process. It's where the toughest, most consequential decisions are made. And to see it done in this manner, it is nothing that I think any of us ever could have expected.
How is this information supposed to be shared between government officials who might be traveling and unable to meet in person?
Well, Leila, almost by definition, the meetings of the Principles Committee are held in the White House Situation Room, perhaps the most secure venue within the U.S. government. And those who are able to be there in person are there in person, literally sitting around the table. But when you're a national security principal, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, often you're called to travel overseas, naturally. Those who can't be there in person are able to join by what's called CIVETS, or Secure Video Teleconference. This is a top secret network that beams them into the White House Situation Room. And whenever a cabinet member within the national security realm travels overseas, he or she has a team that goes before them. They will set up a secure tent, they will set up the camera, so that these individuals are able to join on a secure basis. And not just a secure basis, but a top secret encrypted basis. Even if that fails, Leila, there are fallbacks. And those fallbacks are to join by voice, to join by a top secret, basically a top secret phone that, while you can't see the principal on camera, you can at least hear their voice. Applications like Signal, unclassified cell phones, that, on the other hand, is not something that it would certainly be appropriate for these discussions.
Now, there have been concerns around breaches in the past. For example, Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State under Barack Obama, communicating on a private email server. How unprecedented is this breach?
Well, to my mind, there is no precedent. And you raised the Hillary Clinton case. I think the difference there is that, and there are many of them, I wouldn't even compare the two in some respects, but the key difference is that the Secretary, Secretary Clinton and her team, knew that they were communicating on an unclassified system. And they went to lengths to ensure that, to the best of their ability at the time, to ensure that what they were saying was on an unclassified basis. To my mind, this is very, very different because these individuals, while they knew they were on Signal, a commercial software, on what I suspect were their personal cell phones, not even their government-issued cell phones, they knew they were on this unclassified system, and yet it seems that they were discussing some of the most sensitive elements within the national security realm, information that is so dangerous because it went beyond Yemen. The way Jeffrey Goldberg describes it, he alludes to what we refer to as sources and methods. That is to say, the tactics that the intelligence community and the Defense Department would use against any set of challenges we have, whether it's the Houthis, whether it's a state actor or a non-state actor.
Former State Department spokesman Ned Price, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, veteran reporters Annie Carney and Luke Broadwater share an insider's look at a dysfunctional Congress. The body elected in 2022 passed fewer bills than any Congress since the Great Depression, instead engaging in partisan infighting, petty feuds, and occasionally physical threats. Their book is called Madhouse. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Beijing. When you travel in China, as our team has been doing, you meet a fair number of people who know English. Millions of Chinese citizens have been educated in the United States. They include the top executives of companies, economists, government officials. The president's daughter attended Harvard University. The flow in the other direction is much smaller, but there is some, even in this time of rising tensions between the world's two largest economies. So what is it like for Americans who learn the language of a trading partner and rival? NPR's Emily Fang visited an American elementary school that teaches it.
It's Monday morning at the Yuying Public Charter School in Washington, D.C. I hear Mandarin Chinese floating through the hallways of this 700-person school.
Do you want to speak in English or Chinese?
Lucas Wahib is a 10-year-old student here, and he really wants to speak in Chinese.
你喜欢学中文吗?
Why do you like learning Chinese, I ask him.
很喜欢,因为很难.
I like learning Chinese very much because it's hard, Wahib says.
我也可以说中文,我和我的弟弟。
And he says he and his brother speak in Mandarin with each other, so their parents can't understand them.
这里还有一个十,
the whole idea here in Yuying's classrooms is to immerse kids from the age of 3 in both English and Chinese. The school's principal, Carly Fischero, says most students, including her own kids who attend the school, do not have Chinese ancestry, but
they know the importance of being bilingual or multilingual in an increasingly interconnected global world.
Yuying was founded in 2008, right around the time U.S. interest in Chinese was peaking. Beijing was hosting its first ever Olympics, the Summer Games, to great fanfare.
There was a strong global push to increase the number of Asian languages that U.S. students were learning.
And the following year, then-President Barack Obama announced the 100,000 Strong initiative to get more American students traveling to China. In 2011, those numbers peaked at 15,000 students, but that's all changed. Just a decade after, during the COVID pandemic, that number fell to just 200 American students. It's now still less than 1,000 every semester. Yuying stays away from discussing geopolitics, but sometimes U.S.-China tensions creep in. Fischero says this year her daughter, who studies Mandarin, heard on the news that the U.S. Postal Service was considering banning inbound packages from China.
And she screamed from the back of the car and was like, "No packages from China! That's where we get our curriculum! Are you kidding me? We get our books from China, and we get everything from China!" And I was like, "Yep." She was like, "That's not right."
American universities like the University of Oregon and the University of Washington are reducing Mandarin classes. At Yuying, though, enrollment is increasing. So much so, they just built a second campus.
My Chinese name is Suka.
This is another student here named Francesca Lucia Sousa, almost 11 years old.
Su is for Sousa, and then Ka is for Ka-I, and Ka-I in Chinese means cute, so I'm Sousa Cute.
Language empowers her to connect to more people, she says, including Chinese people.
like, we come up to them, and then we're just like, hey, we speak Chinese, want to talk? And then they talk about, to talk to us about, like, where they're from.
And for her, learning Mandarin Chinese is not about the U.S. versus China. It's a tool for thinking creatively and traveling far, and for Susa, dreaming big. She hopes to work as an interpreter at the United Nations one day. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington. The genetic testing company 23andMe is filing for bankruptcy. Customers spit in a tube and send it to the company for DNA analysis to learn about their health or family history. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports there are privacy concerns about what could happen to all that data.
23andMe said over the weekend that it's entering bankruptcy proceedings in the hope of finding a buyer. The announcement comes just a few months after the California company laid off roughly 40% of its staff. Now, the big question is who that buyer will be and what they will do with the sensitive information of over 15 million 23andMe users. Suzanne Bernstein is counsel at the nonprofit Electronic Privacy Information Center.
The scale of how much highly sensitive data that 23andMe has is unique.
Several states have passed their own genetic privacy laws, but legal experts say federal law has little to say on the subject, and some laws, such as HIPAA, don't apply to direct-to-consumer companies like 23andMe. Here's Anya Prince, a University of Iowa law professor who studies health privacy.
It's really hard to control what happens to your information when it's outside the healthcare space.
She says 23andMe customers worried about a potential sale should consider asking the company to delete their genetic data. 23andMe suffered a major data breach 2 years ago, which impacted nearly 7 million customer accounts. In an open letter to customers on its website, the company now says it's looking for a buyer who, quote, shares in its commitment to customer data privacy. Prince says that while there are open questions about what a potential buyer would do, 23andMe already shares anonymized data, including with pharmaceutical companies.
Everybody's worried about what a new company can do with the data, and that is a concern. But frankly, some of the things that people are worried about, 23andMe already can do or already does.
The company says it'll remain in operation through the bankruptcy proceedings and that customers can still delete their data and shutter their accounts. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, we look at the history of the wild festival that helped define the 90s, Lollapalooza. Ask your smart speaker for your local station, hear it on the radio or in the NPR app. This is NPR News.
The threat of a massive earthquake hangs over the Pacific Northwest, and no one knows when it could strike. For instance, you could be massively pregnant and crib shopping at IKEA.
I wrote this book because I was starting to crack, living with the fear of this.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, the debut novel Tilt by author Emma Patti on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The nation's intelligence chiefs are being grilled about the alleged mishandling of U.S. military strike information shared in a group chat on the unsecured Signal app. The Atlantic's editor-in-chief says he was mistakenly included in the thread about U.S. military plans to bomb Houthi targets in Yemen earlier this month. In today's hearing, the ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner, pressed the director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, about it.
Senator, I'm not going to get into the specifics.
Why are you going to get into the specifics? Is it because it's all classified?
Because this is currently under review by the National Security
Council. Because it's all classified? If it's not classified, share the text now.
President Trump's downplaying the alleged breach via the Signal app, telling NBC it was the only glitch in 2 months and it turned out not to be a serious one. Note, NPR CEO Catherine Marr is on the board of the Signal Foundation. A federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. is considering the administration's request to resume the deportation of alleged Venezuelan gang members under rarely used wartime law. NPR's Joel Rose reports on the dispute over a lower court ruling on due process.
The district court judge in that case has temporarily blocked the administration from deporting anyone under the Alien Enemies Act. The Trump administration argues it should apply here as well because of the threat posed by the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua, which the administration has designated as a foreign terrorist organization.
NPR's Joel Rose reporting. From Washington, this is NPR News. In Turkey, widespread pro-democracy protests are expanding to boycotts and walkouts across the country, 6 days after the arrest of Istanbul's popular mayor on corruption charges. Duri Baskaran reports the mayor's supporters say the charges are politically motivated.
Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu's arrest occurred just days before his political party nominated him as their presidential candidate. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is defending the arrest of İmamoğlu, saying his political party should be accountable for the allegations against him. He accused İmamoğlu's opposition party of disturbing the peace by calling for the demonstrations. Massive crowds of people have gathered nightly at a park across from Istanbul's city hall. Protesters are also boycotting companies with government ties, and students at multiple universities have walked out. For NPR News, I'm Dari Buscarin, Istanbul.
U.S. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy has resigned after 5 years leading the Postal Service, his departure coming at an uncertain time for the agency. Earlier this month, DeJoy announced plans to cut 10,000 workers and billions of dollars from the USPS budget, in line with deep spending cuts across the federal government. President Trump and Elon Musk, the architect of the entity known as the Department of Government Efficiency, have floated the idea of privatizing the nation's mail service. DeJoy was appointed during President Trump's first term. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. New presidential administrations typically swap out some information on government websites, but what's happening now is unusual and to some disturbing. Agencies are trying to comply with President Trump's orders to eliminate anything related to diversity, equity, and inclusion projects. And in doing so, groups of people are disappearing from those websites. NPR's Jing Nan has been reporting on this, and she's with us now. Good morning, Jing Nan. So give us some examples of what these website changes look like.
So we're seeing both historical figures and groups of people removed from the official narrative the government tells about the United States. For example, the Park Service removed references to transgender people from its pages about the Stonewall riots and the history of women's suffrage movement. The military removed pages about the service of women. And the Defense Department also removed some biographies of famous African Americans who served in the military, like baseball player Jackie Robinson. Although Robinson's biography and some others have since been restored. In other instances, we have seen agencies simply removing images of people of color regardless of context.
So is this purge seen to be all about President Trump's DEI executive order?
And his executive orders about defining gender and eliminating references to transgender people. That's a different one. That executive order called trans women men that self-identify as women and frame them without evidence as threats in spaces like domestic abuse shelters and showers. But both of these are central issues for Trump and his allies on the campaign. And to follow this executive order, the military leadership has specifically spelled out in the memo that it wants to get rid of content that focuses on immutable characteristics such as sex and race. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has long said that women should not be in combat roles. Now, the agencies are sometimes walking back their actions. We see NASA took down a bunch of pages featuring scientists and engineers who were women, but later it put them back up. The agency told NPR that it's restoring websites as it figures out how to comply. The military also restored several profiles of famous units and service members after there was public outcry.
So we've been talking about websites here, but are there wider implications of these types of sort of wholesale deletions of information about whole groups of people?
Right. Well, this has people worried. I talked to Sue Fulton. She's a veteran with the advocacy group Spotter Pride. She also used to be a high-level official at the Department of Veteran Affairs.
This administration has hung a sign outside the armed forces saying, if you're not a white male, you are no longer welcome.
I also spoke to some historians, and they raised that the erasure like this has preceded stripping rights from people. One example that came up was 1930s Germany, and here's an example of it playing out right now. In February, the Department of Veteran Affairs started removing some references to transgender people on their website to comply with the executive order. Earlier this month, it removed a key guideline about gender-affirming healthcare. And most recently, the agency has announced that it's going to stop providing all gender-affirming care to new patients altogether. So, yeah, it might start as a page getting removed online, but it does not end there.
That is NPR's Hua Jingnan. Jingnan, thank you.
Thank you.
Home health care workers in Nevada are going to the state capitol today to demand a raise. NPR's Andrea Hsu has the story of one caregiver taking part who took an unusual path to the profession.
Regina Brown Ross has always been a caregiver at heart.
For me, caring has always been a part of my life.
Growing up in Chicago, she helped her mother through bouts of illness. She took care of her sister when she was injured on the job. And a little more than a decade ago, she became a full-time caregiver for her mother-in-law, who was suffering from Alzheimer's.
Which developed and became very difficult.
The timing just happened to work out. Before then, Brown Ross had a whole different career as a singer. Flash, bam, alakazam, wonderful you came back. She performed old standards with jazz orchestras and sang backup for musicians like Ray Charles. There she was as one of the Raylettes on the British TV show Saturday Live in 1996. Later, she moved to Las Vegas to sing with Gladys Knight.
I was at the Flamingo with her.
Then in 2011, she went to China, where she performed shows for an international audience. But there, she got sick.
The smog was so terrible there that it compromised my breath.
Her vocal coach told her, shut it down or lose it. She returned home diminished, unable to sing.
I couldn't sing my phrases. I couldn't hold a note. It was the most devastating time for me.
Unable to tour, Brown Ross needed another job. Back home in Las Vegas, she learned that under a state program, she could formalize taking care of her mother-in-law. She became certified as a caregiver and got hired by an agency that provides in-home care for seniors who qualify for Medicaid. But she discovered the going rate for this essential service was dismal. $10 to $12 an hour.
To go from working with Ray Charles and Gladys Knight making money to being a home care worker was difficult for me, that transition.
It wasn't just the low pay. It was the lack of recognition for the caregivers, mostly women and women of color, who help feed and bathe and provide for the people who can't do it all on their own.
They deserve to have dignity in their own profession.
2 years ago, she was invited to a meeting of the Service Employees International Union, which has organized home health care workers across the country. Soon, she found herself on the bargaining team and part of a larger fight to get the state to set a minimum wage for caregivers for the first time ever at $16 an hour. Brown Ross phone banked and spread leaflets and spoke at a union convention.
And we organized our union with Local 1107.
Her decades on stage made her a natural in front of crowds. She felt energized speaking on behalf of other home caregivers.
Because they need a voice.
Now, 2 years after their first win, Brown Ross and other caregivers are headed back to Carson City to ask for a raise.
We want to go to $20 an hour.
And they have leverage. The number of seniors in Nevada has soared over the past decade. Caregivers are in demand across the country. Regina Brown Ross says this is their moment.
We have to continue to fight, because when we fight, we win. We will have the victory.
More than a decade after she stopped touring, Regina Brown Ross is getting back to singing, resuming some musical projects. But she's not in a hurry. After all, she's already using her voice for a cause she deeply believes in. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, we hear about the USDA's Rural Development Office, damaged by the Trump administration's cuts, but a lifeline to economically depressed rural towns where Trump is popular. Listen on the radio, in the NPR app, or on your smart speaker. Ask for your local station by name. This is NPR News.
Learning more about the Venezuelan men deported by the Trump administration, leading to a fight between the courts and the White House. Next time, here and now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now, we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. A plane from Los Angeles to Shanghai this weekend had to take an unexpected detour. After heading out over the Pacific for a few hours, the plane made a U-turn and landed back in San Francisco. Nothing wrong with the plane, no one was sick. The pilot forgot his passport. United Airlines says this actually happened on another Los Angeles to Shanghai flight earlier this month. Maybe something to add to that pre-flight checklist? It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. Farmers think of feral hogs as a menace. The USDA says they cause at least $2.5 billion in damages every year across 35 states. Kelly Knoyer from member station WHQR reports how trappers are trying to do their part.
Jamie Pearson is a farmer in Sampson County, North Carolina, and he's seen the damage feral hogs can do. 3 years ago, feral hogs struck some of his fields like a hurricane.
I mean, that sounds crazy, but, you know, it don't take them long to go across 150 acres.
He says his hay fields had craters, and his corn fields looked like they had crop circles. He was desperate. And then he found a USDA eradication program. It employs people like trapper Randy Pulley. He is, more or less, at war with feral hogs in rural North Carolina.
Hog trapping is, it takes a lot of patience. Because we don't want to educate. You don't want to catch half the group and educate the other half.
Educate them as in unintentionally teach the remaining hogs how to avoid capture. Yes, hogs are that smart. Pulley uses corral traps on farmers' properties, big circular cages with guillotine doors. He uses cameras to monitor about a dozen traps across multiple counties, and he tries to catch the entire family group in one go.
Because once you drop that door and a pig outside sees that, they're very smart. He's going to learn that. It's ingrained in his mind. You'll never catch him in a trap again, not a corral trap.
When that door falls, the entire sounder, that's what a family group of pigs is called, starts sprinting around the corral. Biologists say trapping is the most effective way to take out feral hogs. You can kill the entire group in one go. Police says hunting them individually isn't as effective.
Going in a cornfield, standing corn when you can't see, you're going row to row. You're trying to get downwind of the pigs. You can hear them breaking. You're trying to get to them without them knowing you're there. You can only see down one row at a time.
But recreational hog hunting is big business in North Carolina. There are over a dozen companies offering hog hunts in the state, including Carolina Razorback Outfitters. Owner Jody Rhodes says it's become his full-time gig. He charges $350 per person per night for hog hunting. Rhodes says hunting helps cut down the population.
If they stop hunting, or i.e. overregulate it, they're just going to increase the population. So if we can't get rid of them, well, let's nurture them. Let's make some money off of them.
But Pulley doesn't think it really helps that much.
Usually recreational hunters are looking to, you know, take the trophy hog, the big hog, the male hog with the, you know, biggest cutters, or they're not there to euthanize the entire group.
A handful of states have banned hog hunting entirely, hoping to end the incentive to have hogs on rural land and eventually eradicate them through trapping. But that's a tough sell, says North Carolina wildlife biologist Fallon Owens. That's because hog hunting culture is well established here.
So it's challenging to institute feral swine hunting bans because of the cultural and socioeconomic benefits that some people have for having feral swine on the landscape.
It's spring now, and those swine are certainly on the landscape, eating corn seeds and keeping Pulley on his toes.
Now I'm out 4, sometimes 5 nights a week, weekends, so it's very, very busy.
He'll be waking up every time his phone goes off, telling him hogs have entered his traps. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Knoyer in Sampson County, North Carolina.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. When you think of the harp, what comes to your mind? Probably not African-American spirituals, not to mention jazz or West African rhythms. But after you hear Ashley Jackson's new album, you will think of all of these musical genres. I spoke with Ashley Jackson in our New York studios. She joined us with her harp, and she told me about the concept behind her latest release. It's called Take Me to the Water.
In African-American spirituals, for me, the ingenuity lies in the coded language. Looking at the lyrics, I was captivated by, you know, water being the symbol of freedom, of being a symbol of hope for my ancestors. And I also was thinking a lot about my grandmother and my experiences going to church with her. And being a young kid and just, you know, not understanding everything about the service, but being so moved by the music and how it, you know, made the congregation get up to their feet and sing and clap and dance. African-American spirituals were a necessary form of communication between the enslaved. They couldn't explicitly express their desires for freedom, right? Because that would sound many alarms. So water becomes a metaphor for freedom.
Did you have a eureka moment when you realized that you did not have to separate the world that you grew up in from the world that you have learned?
When I was coming to the end of my doctoral studies at Juilliard, I was researching the composer Margaret Bonds, who is of African American descent. And she was really kind of a role model. She was somebody who had integrated her upbringing in the church, constantly using the words of Black poets in her music. And so I felt like, okay, if she did it, maybe there's a space for me.
For Troubled Water, you developed a technique to mimic movement on water. Will you tell me about that?
Well, in so Troubled Water by Margaret Bonds is originally for piano. And in a recording session, we were, you know, starting the opening and it's low in the strings. So it's kind of muddy. It was a little too muddy. And I thought, well, I have a pair of socks in my in my purse. And when our daughter was very young, I used to really kind of mute the strings by weaving, you know, different headscarves just to make the strings really quiet.
So that she could nap while you were practicing.
While I was practicing.
Can you show me?
Sure. I don't have my pair of socks today, but. So it begins in this very low rumbling, kind of murky water, so to speak.
I do love the way you incorporate different rhythms into the work. I must say I love Yemaya. It's almost like it takes over your body. It almost like infuses itself.
It does. In the recording session, I said, okay, this needs to feel like we're in the depths of water. I now live in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. So in terms of imagery, I was thinking about our swamps and, you know, my ancestors kind of moving slowly, perhaps towards freedom. And what I did was I superimposed the melody of an Afro-Cuban chant over some music by a friend of mine, Joao Luis, who's a guitarist and composer. And it allowed us to kind of enter a different sound world altogether.
Another composer that you lift up on this album is Ellis Coltrane.
Yes.
The wife of John Coltrane, the famous kind of jazz saxophonist. Tell us about her.
I was first introduced to her music through my father, who was a lover of jazz. After I became a mother, kind of that first year, I had an opportunity to play her music with a small orchestra. What resonated with me most was her experience as a mother and an artist, that she really talked about being a mother and an artist and a wife in this beautiful, holistic way. And for me, as a young mother, working from home during the pandemic, raising our young daughter, it really spoke to me, and just the love that she had and the spirituality that she kind of walked through life with gave me something during that time.
Samuel Coleridge Taylor is another composer that you highlight on this album. Tell us about him.
Samuel Coleridge Taylor is an Afro-British composer. He ranged 24 African-American, but also African and Caribbean spirituals for solo piano. And Deep River, to me, was, you know, it's such an iconic American melody. I had to include it
on
this album.
Could you play a little bit of it for
me? Oh, sure, yes.
Is harpist Ashley Jackson. Her new album is Take Me to the Water. Ashley Jackson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
What would you like to play us out on?
I think I have to play Take Me to the Water. That's the name of the album, so let's do it.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Listen to me, dear school girls. At me, do not shake your flesh. For what I'm going to say to you, you will find I'm also true. If only you're ambitious, yes, ever so fastidious. Please digest them word for word. They will help you to go forward. Learn to be the best of school girls.